And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a wild, wild world out there, and that's what we're here to tell you about. It is the Wild Side News and the voice of the earth. And our voice keeps reaching around the world and getting new listeners. So today, we provide a sampler of the wonders of this planet, from presidents to parks to plants, just the other side of this short break. So get ready to take your pick from a great new show when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Presidents, parks, and plants. What do they have in common? They all start with P, and each one ends in S. But you know, that's not enough to build a show around. No. There is more. And today, we build this show in reverse. That is, we start out with the show, then find out what we've learned, rather than have me tell you up front what you are about to learn. That is, after all, how life works. One day you show up on Earth, you stick your bare feet on the ground, you fall, you get up, you fall some more, and now, here you are, listening to me, with lots of other people. When you started out, did you have a plan or a synopsis? No. And yet, here now, everyone on the earth is spinning together, round and round and round, day after day, weeks turn into months, and still, we on the earth here spin together, year after year, and that's the way it's going to be for a very long time. We here in the U.S. hear about things around the planet that seem to affect us, things in Iraq and China most directly, although no matter how long we spin, we'll never catch up with them. That is, they are always exactly the same distance away every single day. We all think about our neighbors, the street, the houses, the trees, but they are spinning just like you. And they too generally are exactly the same distance from you, day in, day out, unless, of course, you're away from home, or they are. But late at night, when the neighbors are sleeping, you are all spinning together, locked into this personal geographic distribution of souls, spinning. What's amazing is that there are people in Paris right now who have been exactly the same distance away from you for years. And of course, there are people all over the earth, in Moscow and Beijing, Cleveland and Mozambique, who you have spent years and years being exactly the same distance away from. We are all locked into and onto this spinning planet more tightly than we care to think about. Hopefully, nothing will ever smash into the earth and rock this rolling ride we call life on planet Earth, or we'd all fly out of kilter together. Since the Earth is about 26,000 miles in diameter, and it takes 24 hours to make one turn, that means you're traveling about 1,000 miles an hour. Right now, we all are. We're all spinning towards a common destiny, and most of us are exactly the same distance from billions of others as we always are when we're at home. It's like a great big dorm house. We tend, for some reason, to ignore the spinning, because generally we don't feel or see it. At least, that's what we seem to think. But it's really easy for each of us to sense that spin in reality. Here's the easiest way I know to feel it. Next time you've finished your day, like today for example, I want you to take a few minutes to watch the sunset. It's a worthy thing to do almost any day. But this time, when the sun starts to disappear below the edge of the earth, I want you to hop on the planet, and as you watch, feel the earth turn. Because that is what's happening. You're watching the earth turn, spinning away from the sun, round and round, and then you continue your journey, spinning into evening and then into the darkness of another night, you and your neighbors across the street and around the world, it's just another day. And now, the news. Regular listeners to the Wild Side News may be a little perplexed to hear so much talk about energy on a nature show. But there is a secret agenda that keeps spinning the energy news into the nature show, and that is that global warming, extraction of coal, oil, and gas leases on public lands, and the need to extract ever and greater resources to fuel the growing demands of a global society are leading to an out-of-control attack on the natural world. And so we continue. The Senate unveiled its latest draft of an energy bill this past week. After months of wrangling, the Energy Committee revealed certain provisions of their version of the energy bill recently passed by the House. The new Senate version focuses its attention on coal, electricity, hydrogen, and nuclear power plants. It does include provisions to direct the President to reduce U.S. oil demand by 1 million barrels a day by 2015. Now that's aggressive. Increase the U.S. emergency oil reserve from 700 million barrels to 1 million barrels. Impose reliability operating standards on utilities to protect against blackouts. Authorize $50 million, that's $50 million over 5 years, for rebates to consumers who buy energy-efficient appliances. And it extends tax credits to companies that generate electricity by wind, solar, and geothermal. However, 93% of the $8 billion in tax incentives go to oil and traditional energy industries. The struggle over ANWR's future has not yet been worked out. U.S. Representative Jay Inslee, a Democrat from Washington State, is preparing to introduce a new Apollo Energy Act, which will provide $49 billion in government loan guarantees for construction of clean energy generation facilities that will produce power from wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, oceans, coal with carbon sequestration technologies, and other sources. The legislation will also commit $10.5 billion to research and development investment tax credits for clean energy producing operations. In addition, it includes a 10-year extension of the current credit for electricity generated from clean sources. Inslee stated that making these clean energy sources cost-effective for citizens will require this type of bold infrastructure investment by the federal government. It seems this Apollo project concept is heading for the launch pad. The countdown is beginning. We are at 10 minus 9 years and counting. The decade of discovery is about to begin. And that's the news. President's Parks and Plants continues. I now want to deliver an open letter to President Bush. Dear Mr. President, I'm scared. And I don't want to be. I'm scared because when I look out, a lot of my friends are scared too. Oh, it's not like they are hiding in the basement, cringing. No, it's a brave, silent sort of scare, like when you think something bad is about to happen, but you don't want to let on that that's what you're feeling. But lots of people feel it. There's so much hostility and rancor. It's odd. It's strange. It just seems that the polarization is getting worse instead of better. And it just does not feel right. And it's not just here at home. It's all around the world. The bombings in Iraq kill more and more people each day. 7, 17, 31, 45, 68, 106, 200. Where does this escalation stop? And now a small obscure item in a Newsweek magazine throws thousands and thousands of Muslims into the streets and more people are killed. And then we hear it was a mistake or things are spinning out of control. As Americans, we just keep getting up each morning to face another day. Great news, we hear. The price of gas just dropped. Sign of better times, I guess. It's down 2 cents. Of course, it's up 100% since last year. I guess we should be thrilled. But this is getting really old. And then those of us who live in towns across America, who look on out at the distant hills or drive past the town parks or take a drive into the country on a weekend to find a little peace, we notice the way in which the trees are disappearing. The views from our picture windows that used to look out on our towns and fields are gone. Our vistas are being taken away with houses and developments almost everywhere. We notice it. And the hills in the distance, the trees are disappearing. There's holes in our forests where people now live, or where edges are thinned back, and we see it. And on our long journeys, we see the scars on the mountainsides, where the big forests are being logged. And we know that the roads you propose to go into those forests will lead to huge scars. We know it. It's getting to the point, in some places, that nothing is sacred any longer. And to many of us who feel the spirit of the land, who grew up loving America for its grandness and the way people seem to get along, it just seems to be disappearing. It is disappearing. It doesn't have to. So many of us see clearly a way to restore a hope for a United States of America. Oil. Why is it so important to keep pushing this country further and further to the edge when we all know, the whole world knows, that oil is killing us? But we know it's obvious why. But you are the president, and this is your last term. You have it within you to stand tall and lead, don't you? The other day, you addressed a gathering at a biodiesel fuel factory and delivered an energy speech. You talk of the need to get oil out of Anwar. You speak of nuclear. You say nuclear, but we understand. But the thing that was most confusing was when you said that we must help the Chinese and the Indian governments learn how to become more efficient users of oil, because that will help us. And I just froze. Let me quote you. "It's in our economic interest, in our national interest, to help countries like India and China become more efficient users of oil. That would help take the pressure off global oil supply, take the pressure off prices here at home." Does it make any sense to offer help to other nations to become more efficient and therefore more competitive with America and less dependent on the world's oil reserves before you make that effort for us? Wouldn't a real leader make sure to do absolutely everything he could to help us first so that we can become freed from the world oil monopoly? Why would you want to help other nations achieve that objective before you help us achieve that objective? Oh, come on, help us. You could commit your full powers as president to harness the free energy that comes our way every single day from the sun and the wind and the waves. We need that now, Mr. President. You know, you have a thing with oil. We know it. But we're calling out, Mr. President, please stop. Your time is running out. But you know what? Our patience is too. And you know, we know. I'm scared. It reminds me of a movie from the 50s, somewhere in Texas, with kids in jalopies, crazy, goofy, out-of-control kids, heading to the edge of town to play chicken. No one wanted to be chicken. It was a crazy game with life, a possible head-on collision. Stop now. Help. Lead. Come on, Mr. President. It's not funny.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
There are things about America that are so grand. We have in our great legacy a common connection with the land that has been the life force of freedom. It has been locked up, thank God, in our wondrous national parks. As summer spins our way, it's time to return to our national parks and soak up the soul of the open spaces. And there is no place that offers that possibility like the place we head to next. We're off to the Grand Canyon as the voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This summer, I hope each of you commits to visit a national park. Trust me, it's not because the parks need you exactly, but you can be assured that you need the park. Each national park has its own character, from national seashores and scenic riverways to America's historic battlefields and the soul of the birth of a nation. America's national parks hold our legacy. And certainly the grandest of the grand is the Grand Canyon. So now, let's find out what you will find when you go west to the Great Divide. So to tell us about all the wonderful things that are going to be happening at the Grand Canyon National Park this year is Judy Bryan, who is the Chief of Interpretation. Judy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you sit in one of the most amazing parks. I can imagine there may be a few people who haven't been there, but if by chance someone has never been there, how in the world could you describe Grand Canyon National Park?
Oh, that's a hard question. I can't think of one word to describe it. I think it's spectacular beauty and in a harsh environment that is just a breathtaking conglomeration of beautiful scenery and intimate places.
It is one of the most awe-inspiring places probably in the world that we have easy access to. One could climb to a 30,000-foot mountain and possibly get a similar experience. But for those of us who probably are going to hop in our vehicle and drive someplace and hope to be inspired, this really is a pinnacle experience. Obviously, what most people come there for are these spectacular views of the deep, deep canyon. Tell us how people can actually best experience that.
What we usually tell visitors to do when they get here is just find a place on the rim to get their first view of the canyon and just sit and enjoy it and watch the light change and just reflect on what that vast space and what those beautiful colors and the vastness of the canyon mean to you as a person. There's access to the rim from both the north side and the south side, so you have a number of ways of getting here and different views along the way.
Well, there are a lot of ways to experience the park, and we're going to talk a little bit about those things. First of all, the most common way to experience the park, and one that all of the interpreters are trying to help people go beyond, but that is through with your car. And quite honestly, you can really have a terrific adventure if you're limited to your car at Grand Canyon National Park.
Yes, you can. We have 30 miles of developed road along the south rim and miles of scenic roads along the north rim. But we always do recommend that visitors get out of their car and just sit in a quiet space somewhere along the rim. All you really have to do is walk 5 or 10 minutes from one of the overlooks, and you have the canyon to yourself.
Which is spectacular. And as you say, spending time there, I think, is one of the best ways to do that, because something happens. I think the millions and millions and millions of years that this canyon has been there begin to sort of impart its spirit and soul into the visitor. If they really spend a little bit of time there, somehow that magic happens.
Yes, it does. Just watching what we say is the clouds dancing around the canyon can give it a totally different perspective for you as the light changes and you get different perspectives on how deep and wide the canyon is, as opposed to when you might see it for 5 minutes on a sunny day. It just changes everywhere you go, every time of day. Every viewpoint of the canyon will give you a totally different perspective on it. And just walking 5 minutes down one of the trails and looking back up gives you an unbelievable perspective on the vastness of this place and the power of the canyon to really change some people's lives.
It should be mandatory. If you come that far and you don't get out of your car, well, shame on you. I'm just going to say, get out of your car and go walk to the rim, and then watch your breath be taken away.
Exactly. We always recommend that to people. Don't just drive your car to the rim, but get out and enjoy it.
Well, there's lots of other ways, too. Now, some people, of course, would like to come to the canyon and spend more time. What are some of the opportunities there?
Well, we offer, during the summer months, we offer over 25 different interpretive programs a day that focus on different aspects of the canyon, be it geology or the natural history, the Native American stories. Native Americans have been in this area for over 12,000 years, so there's a rich history there. We do programs that talk about the different types of inspiration that have come out of the canyon, art and poetry and music, all the different things for 150 or more years that have inspired people to write and about the Grand Canyon and draw it.
Now, of course, some people may wish to camp, and talk about what those opportunities are.
Well, we have all different types of camping. You can bring your RV into the camp, into the park, and camp along the rim at an RV park. We've got a tent campground on the south rim in two different locations. And on the north rim, there's a campground that accommodates both recreational vehicles and tents. And then there's always below the rim camping, carrying your tent on your back along with all the food and water that you need to experience the canyon. Day hiking below the canyon does not require a permit, but going down and spending the night does require a permit. And if you go onto the park's website, you can find out how to get one of those permits.
Now, for people who are, let's say, going to bring in their RV or something, is it recommended that they get reservations in advance?
Yes, it is. Especially during the summer months, we recommend that both for RV and tent camping, if you're going to be on the rim, that you do try and make a reservation ahead of time.
How many people come to Grand Canyon each year?
We get over 4.5 million visitors each year. Most of those are visiting the south rim, but about 10% of our visitors actually visit the north rim, which is only 10 miles as the condor flies across the canyon, but it's a 250-mile drive from rim to rim.
Wow. How many people does that come out to be in a typical day at the park?
Our estimates for typical day visitation is about 25 to 30,000 a day.
Wow.
It's a lot. But remember, it's a 1.5 million acre park.
It's
a lot of space.
There is. Actually, I don't think it really feels that crowded, even with that number there. Well, let's talk about kind of taking that adventure and taking that walk down into the canyon. There's a lot to that. It's not the type of thing that you want to do if you're not sure you can do it.
No, it's not. The canyon is actually a desert environment. It's 7,000 feet on the south rim, 8,000 feet on the north rim. And the canyon changes in elevation about 5,000 feet or a vertical mile between the rim and the river. And although it may be a pleasant 75-80 degree day on the rim, it can be 20 to 25 degrees hotter on the bottom of the canyon. So it is a harsh desert environment, and there's not a whole lot of water down there, so you have to be prepared carrying food and water with you.
And also you have to be prepared to realize that your muscles may not just carry you the whole route.
Yes, it's true. It's opposite for most people's hiking experience. Most of the time when you hike, you're used to going up a mountain or up a hill and then turning around when you're tired and hiking back down, which is a lot easier. At the canyon, you're actually hiking down into the canyon, and then when you turn around to come out, you've got that mountain to climb when you're already tired.
Now, of course, you don't necessarily have to walk all the way down and back up again. There are some options, aren't there?
Oh, there's all kinds of options. You can walk down any of the trails as far as you want to or as short as you want to. The primary hiking trails from the South Rim are the South Kaibab and the Bright Angel Trail, and both of them are 7.5 miles down to the river, but you can walk down each trail 5 minutes or 10 minutes, depending on your desire and your skill level.
And the mule trips, are they still available?
The mules are still going on. They've been taking visitors into the canyon for over 100 years. Now, those reservations need to be made way in advance. We do get cancellations on a daily basis, but most of those are booked about 18 months out.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, for people who wish to really go kind of in the upscale fashion, you do have some legendary lodges.
Yes, we do. The El Tovar, which is the oldest lodge on the rim, celebrating its 100th birthday this year. It was opened in 1905. We've got the Bright Angel Trail, which was actually built by one of the famous Southwest architects named Mary Jane Coulter. She's one of the few women architects of the early 20th century. And we've got the Yavapai and the Maswick, which aren't right on the rim, but they're very popular for people to stay in. On the north rim is the Grand Lodge at Grand Canyon. It was also built in the early 20th century.
Now let's go to the other extreme, and that would be the backcountry experiences. What kind of opportunities exist?
Well, there's the most popular opportunities are what we call the Corridor Trail backpacking experience, which is a 26-mile trail that crosses the canyon, and it starts or ends on the north rim and starts or ends on the south rim. And along that, you've got three campgrounds, the Cottonwood Campground, Phantom Ranch, which is located along the Colorado River at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and Indian Garden Campground. Those are the primary areas that a lot of people go to in their first experience. And then there's 1.1 million acres of backcountry that are open to camping and backpacking.
Do you require some permits for that?
Yes, permits are required. They are let out 4 months in advance of your desired desired dates, and all the information on that is also on our website.
I hear that you've had some special events this last spring that were marking the 100th anniversary, and tell us about that.
That's right. This spring, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of both the El Tovar, which is the Grand Hotel on the south rim of the canyon, and the Hopi House, which was also designed by Mary Jane Coulter, and both of those facilities are still operated by the Santa Fe Railroad Company that, or its derivation, and open to the public.
Now, I hear you have some relatively new residents in the park that are getting quite a bit of attention, and these are some of the most spectacular birds we're ever going to find anywhere in the world.
That's right, Sydney. The California condor, which was on the brink of extinction in the 1980s, is back at Grand Canyon National Park. Through the Peregrine Fund, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and some other organizations, the park has participated in a reintroduction program. And if you're at the Grand Canyon during the late spring, summer, and fall months, you're very likely to see a California condor soaring over the Grand Canyon. They are one of the most endangered species in the world, and they are just spectacular birds. They have a 9.5-foot wingspan and are just beautiful birds as they just soar on the currents over the canyon.
I've never seen a condor, and this is a terrific reason for me to revisit, as if I needed a good reason to revisit the Grand Canyon, but that would be exciting to see.
It is. We have a lot of visitors who come into the visitor center, and one of the first questions they ask is, where can I go to see a California condor? The program has been very successful here. We've had three condors that were actually hatched and fledged in the wild here at Grand Canyon. It's a very successful program.
Now, of course, I suppose 25 years from now, they may be renamed the Grand Canyon Condor, which has kind of a nice feel to it.
Well, it does. I doubt it'll happen, though. I think California has the real spin on that. They've also got quite a large reintroduction program over there.
That sounds so exciting. So you've been at the park about 5 years.
Correct.
I suppose you're gearing up for the summer these days, and you're having all sorts of new interpreters and returning interpreters coming back to the park.
Yes, we are. We start our summer season Sunday, May 22nd, and at that time we will have 5 or 6 new staff and returning staff members on to provide programs to the public all along the south and the north rim.
Those are extraordinarily fun times. I wish I could be there.
Well, come join us.
I just may decide to stop by. If I do, I'll give you a call.
Okay.
Well, listen, now let's talk about people who want to come to the park. What's the best way to get there?
Well, if you want to go to the North Rim, the best way to get there is to fly or drive towards Las Vegas and drive across the Arizona Strip and down into the North Rim. It's a beautiful forested drive. As compared to coming to the South Rim, you're basically driving over from Vegas or up from Phoenix through the Sonoran and Mojave Deserts, and coming up into the Ponderosa Forest of the South Rim through Flagstaff or Williams, Arizona, or from the Navajo Nation out on the east side of the park.
It is truly spectacular in every dimension and from every perspective. Judy, you've been there for 5 years now. What is your favorite aspect of the park?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question.
I'm going to ask it anyway.
My favorite thing to do, I get to do this afternoon, I'm actually going to hike down into the canyon and just find a quiet spot to sit on a rock and, as I said before, watch the clouds dance and listen to people experience the canyon. It's one of those places where even those of us that get to live and work here on a year-round basis, just listening to what new visitors have to say about this place is really refreshing. But just any place in the canyon where you can find a quiet spot is really what I enjoy doing.
I do believe that there's many people who would have a life-changing experience if they could do that.
Oh, I think so. I feel very lucky and privileged to get to be here.
Judy Bryan, Chief of Interpretation at Grand Canyon National Park, thanks so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
You're more than welcome, and come visit us this summer.
I'm going to, for sure. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So while you visit a national park, take time to head on out on your own. And when you do, bring along a sketchbook and something to draw with. Because after listening to our next segment, you will learn how you, yes, you, can learn the joys of drawing the wondrous nature and beauty of the plants when we return as we celebrate life in its grandeur here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever run into a kid who doesn't like to draw? Everyone starts out drawing. Some continue, some don't. Well, for those of you who have kept up, you're about to get a refresher course on one of the most enjoyable ways you can enhance your outdoor experience, drawing plants. They're everywhere and provide an unlimited source of pleasure. And if you're one who thinks you can't, give it up. You can. Find out how when we return here on the Wild Side News. This is going to be fun. Now, I don't care whether you think you can draw or not. You are about to learn. Today, we focus on drawing plants. We're surrounded by plants, and the wonderful thing about them is that they all follow a very similar design. I guarantee you, you will make improvement if you give this a try. Now, this is the third in the series on drawing nature. You can easily find the previous shows by going to the archives and looking under the art category. There you'll find the May 20th, 2004 show on field journaling, which focused on a thumbnail sketch, and journaling, the July 15th show, which was an introduction to making and embellishing journals. For today's show, all you'll need is a few pieces of paper and a pencil or a pen. Keep in mind that at any time you can pause this webcast to practice, which is key. Or come back and listen anytime, from any place, if you want to replay the show. So, let's get started. I will provide images of simple plants on today's webpage, but be sure to use this information and go on out and draw from life. That's enjoyable. To follow along on today's show, click on where it says, "Click here to follow along," in segment 3. That will take you to the page of illustrations. Follow along as we go. Now, go to Illustration 1. The first rule of everything in nature, there are no straight lines. Absolutely everything in the living world is composed of curves, and the secret of nature's unlimited beauty is that the curves are beautiful. So to learn to draw plants, you have to learn to draw curves. We will look at various aspects of plants, then learn how to finally draw a whole plant. Let's start out with a few simple exercises. I want you to practice drawing long, beautiful curves. You can see examples on today's page. When you hear this sound, it means this might be a good time to pause the show and practice. So when you hear the sound, pause your player and draw some curved lines. When you are ready to continue, hit the play button on your player. Okay. Draw. Go to number 2. Here you will notice a variety of leaves. The best way to draw a leaf is to start with a midrib, that heavy vein down the middle of the leaf. Now take a look, and you will see that that midrib is a very simple long curve. That's going to be the case in almost every single leaf. So draw a long, smooth curve to represent a midrib. Now notice the shape of the leaf is also a curve, but it is a series of curves. Number 3. Then you talk your way around the edge of the leaf. A short inside curve, then a long outside curve, and then a short inside curve to the point. Number 4. Now try different combinations of inside and outside curves, trying to repeat them on both sides of the stem. Talk your way through. You will find these combinations almost always look like a leaf you've seen somewhere. Number 5. Now pay attention to how the plant is constructed. There are 3 basic forms. You can refer to these photos. Alternate has leaves growing off the stem alternately. Opposite has leaves growing opposite one another. And basal has the leaves growing from the base or the ground. So pay attention, because when you draw these plants, you'll want to be able to identify, is it alternate, opposite, or basal, and then draw it that way. Number 6. Then realize that in any plant, from a flower to a tree, nature likes to repeat itself. So on any plant, take a survey of what angle the leaf grows from the stem. I like to refer to it by the hour hand of a clock, such as a 1 o'clock angle, a 2 o'clock angle, even a 1:15 angle. We are very sensitive to these differences. Now make sure that every leaf comes off of every stem, and every stem comes off of each branch at the same angle, and you will suddenly find a beautiful, lifelike drawing emerging. 7. This is fun. It's easy to draw a twisted leaf. Start with the midrib. Somewhere, cross the midrib and return to the point. Then, start on the other side of the midrib, cross at the same place on the midrib, and continue to the point. Voila! A twisted leaf. 8. Now, let's put it all together. Start with the stem of a plant. Draw in the midribs, coming off the stem, always the same angle. They can then curve in interesting ways. Then simply repeat the leaf type, sometimes making some twist. And there you have a wonderful lifelike plant. Now go on out and enjoy nature. By observing how it all truly fits together, you will begin to see the nature of nature and start to sense the magic and beauty of our living world. Be sure to bring along paper and pencil or pen when you head out, and then have fun. So here we are at another endpoint of the Wild Side News. When we began, I said we'd save the message to the end of the show instead of the beginning. But my time is up, so I'm going to have to let you draw your own insights into the nature of this show. So this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again each Thursday or any time on the archives on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.